Howdy, everybody. This is Jefferson Smith. You're listening to Thank You Democracy on X-Ray. It's a legislative session. A lot of stuff goes on during legislative session. And the legislative session, relative to a two-year biennium is one way of saying a two-year period. Legislative session is relatively short. Really, only one quarter of every 2 years is legislature in session. Most of that one quarter happens in a single five-month period, which we're almost halfway over right now. Something interesting happened just yesterday. The education budget was voted out of the Ways and Means Subcommittee. Wow, that sounds fascinating. It might not sound fascinating to you right now, but I'm going to explain why it's fascinating. And we're going to get into it a little bit later. And we're going to talk about education, what's happening in higher education, what's happening in Oregon that might change the landscape of higher education funding if it's successful forever. But what's interesting about the fact that they passed the education budget early, I'll give you two interesting things. First, it usually happens at the very end of session. They moved it early. Second, Republicans are just decrying that it's not enough. So are Republicans the party of education in Oregon right now? We'll talk about that. And why is it that the education budget is being decried by education advocates? But before that, we want to talk about reforms. On Thank You Democracy, we try to talk about solutions, not only problems. And here is one potential solution. It's called Pay It Forward. Now, usually what you do in higher education these days is you get a loan and you pay it back. The average student in the United States has about $30,000 in debt. That doesn't mean if they graduated, they have $30,000 in debt. That's on average. So everybody who borrowed over $100,000 is offset by the people who maybe didn't even finish. And here in Oregon, in just public schools, not counting our private schools, that debt is about $26,000 on average for every student. We have Alejandro Juarez, the communications director from the Oregon Working Families Party. We're also going to have Carly Gibson from Portland State University. And in a little bit, we're going to have Ben Cannon, the executive director for higher education in Oregon, the main policy bureau worker in our state, to talk about what's happening with higher education funding and what's happening with this proposal that is called Pay It Forward. Alejandro, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right, man, what's Pay It Forward?
So Pay It Forward is a solution to public higher education student loan debt, where we are proposing that the state covers tuition up front in exchange for a small percentage of the student's future wage for a period of time. In this case, 20 years, and the percentages vary whether you go to a two-year institution or a four-year institution. So 3%, 2 or 3% or 4% for four-year university.
How is it different from the current system?
Well, the innovation around Pay It Forward is that it's not a loan. It wouldn't impact students in the same way that loans do, in that it won't affect their credit, they won't go into default, and it won't impact their ability to own a home. The other thing is that it would offset the amount of debt that they would accumulate just by student loans alone, and there's no varying interest rates.
So you get locked in at 4% of your income, not increasing the number of years you pay. How many years do you have to pay it back at 4%?
Well, right now the pilot calls for 20 years.
So the deal I make, now this is imposed upon me like Obamacare, or this is something I can opt into like not Obamacare?
It's totally opt-in. It's another option. It's another choice that people have. So it works similarly into a loan that way, in that you can take out as much Pay It Forward as you need if you're in a four-year institution. Let's say you need help with the next 2 years, then you can take 2 years of Pay It Forward and pay that off.
So under the Alejandro Juarez plan, okay, which I think is going to be named after you.
Okay.
According to the Working Families Party plan, if I'm a student starting at Portland State, University of Oregon, Oregon State, et cetera, I would have a handful of choices. One, to drop out.
Yeah.
Two, to spend my many hundreds of thousands of dollars that I have in my pocket on school, just pay it out of pocket. Three, to take some loans, maybe mix that in with option four of grants and get my parents to give me some money and get a job and cobble together a funding plan for college, as happens with lots of families over the last, you know, let's call it 30 years since college started getting really expensive. Or five, make a deal and say, all right, you're going to get college paid for in full or in part?
You're going to get your tuition and fees paid for.
Tuition in full, not tuition and fees in full, not room and board, but tuition and fees in full. And all you got to do is give us 4% of your income, whatever your job is, whatever you make, after you graduate for 20 years. That's it?
Right.
So why is that better than, and I can offer some answers, but you should offer the answers. Right. Why is that better than just a plan that says, hey, rather than a fixed percentage, why don't you pay a fixed amount? And that's what, by the way, a loan is called.
Well, the big problem right now is that we are in a student debt crisis, and the average amount that students are in debt right now in Oregon is $26,000, which is a huge amount. It's a down payment in a home. And the problem with that is that this money, the loan money, is not actually staying in Oregon. It's going to the lenders' accounts that could be either in the country or offshore, and it's not circulating back into Oregon. The benefit for individuals is that they don't have to, it states a sense of stability for students, where they don't have to cobble together every term money to pay for their tuition. It's covered, and they don't have to worry about asking their parents or their grandparents who are in retirement, or figuring out how they're going to take out those loans. The other thing that's better about this is that there are no varying interest rates. So in the last 2 years, the federal student loan rate went up, doubled, right, from 3% to 6%, and that hurt lots of students in around the country. So it makes it stable, and it is more affordable than a loan would be.
When we were talking before the show, you likened it to Social Security. Make that case.
Well, it's like Social Security in reverse. Instead of getting your benefits after the end of your career, you get them at the beginning. And then you're on the hook for paying for contributing to that for 20 years after that.
What's the pushback you're getting? I can think of one already.
We're getting some pushback from people who would rather see us advocate for more funding in the state. For public higher education, Oregon is currently 47th in public higher education spending, which means that in Oregon, you really have to take out loans in order to afford an education, or you can be wealthy and pay it outright.
We have on the phone right now Carly Gibson, a senior at Portland State University, to bring a student perspective, because, heck, that's one of the things we do up in here. Carly, how you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
I am well. Are you in between classes? Are you sitting in the back not paying attention in geology? What's going on in your world?
I'm actually enjoying spring break right now.
Spring break. Are you doing that in Cancun? Are you doing that? It's spring break. My senior year in high school, I went to Sitka, Alaska, which is not a traditional spring break locale. What sunny place where Van Halen plays do you spend your spring breaks?
The Paradise City.
All right. So the question I've got for you is, why'd you start getting involved in this? You went down to lobby in Salem. You decided to intern at Working Families Party. You're a college student who's become an advocate for this. How come?
Well, I am currently $20,000+ in debt, and I have spent the past 5 years of my college career wondering how I'm going to pay for my next year of college rather than being able to completely focus on my school studies. And that's a huge problem, I think.
Yeah, is that problem limited to you? Sounds like it's not.
Oh, definitely not. I'm pretty sure, I'm positive it's something almost everyone goes through while they're in college.
So you decided to lobby on this. You decided to push for this 20-year pay for 4% back plan, regardless of what you make. And what have surprised you most about getting involved in this process?
What surprised me? Probably the arguments that people have made against Pay It Forward.
Like what?
I've heard things like, if students have their tuition paid for, then they're not going to want to graduate with their degree, which I find a little absurd, considering the fact I'm attending colleges not to rack up debt, but to earn a degree and pursue my career.
Just be like Bluto from Animal House, 7 years in college, 0.0. I understand. And you're saying you don't think that's the thing. What other arguments have you heard that have surprised you?
One thing I've heard is that people are viewing higher education as a privilege, and I don't think that's fair. I think higher education should be seen as something that everyone can obtain, and not just for those who can afford it, but for everyone who wants to pursue a career.
What are the interest groups, Alejandro, that you've seen opposed to this? Now, I have heard two powerful arguments you're going to have to get around, okay? Mm-hmm. And each of them have constituencies. The first, and this is part of, we have not yet dubbed this segment or this type of conversation the sausage, but I think that's what we're going to talk about, what we're going to call it, and we talk about actually how this stuff happens. So a little bit of sausage. In Salem, you're getting the argument opposed to the bill that, wait a minute, if an engineer or a lawyer or a doctor or somebody who anticipates making a high salary is starting college, why should they have to pay the same 4%, which means they're paying a lot more for their higher education than a person who... Carly, what are you going to be when you grow up?
High school English teacher.
Then Carly, who's going to be a high school English teacher. So it's a good deal for Carly, but it's a bad deal for somebody else. And your response is?
My response is that, I think people have ideas about what people will be making after they graduate, but no one starts off making their full bottom wage at once they get out of college. They start in an entry level job, and they won't actually be paying more than anybody else. And then, to be honest, a lot of these degrees, or when people talk about
it's a fair point, at least for the first few years. But after 10, you're paying back for 20 years.
Right.
After 8 years, right. After 15, let's take somebody who goes to law school and then spends 3 years in law school, spends 7 years or 8 years becoming a partner. So that's 10 years, right?
Right.
So that for that first 10 years. They'll make a little bit more than Carly, but maybe not
always. I think that's also a myth, right? I think people think about lawyers and think about software engineers. And when you're looking at it right now, like CNN just has an article online where they're talking about how these software engineers are making around $34,000 while these companies are like Google are making, billions of dollars. The wages are not, set in stone, and they're definitely not the same across the board. So the key here is that pay it forward is an option. No one's getting forced into participating into Pay It Forward, but it also helps people who wouldn't even be able to get that education in the first place. So we've talked to a lot of students who are students of color who just can't imagine to go affording school, and they want to be engineers, they want to be doctors, but they won't be able. Their families won't take on any more debt. So we would be providing an option for people to be able to afford their education, and the agreement is that they will be paying it back.
On the phone right now is Ben Cannon, the executive director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. I hope I have that acronym right. Mr. Cannon, Ben, how you doing, man?
I'm great. How are you, Jeff?
I am well. So we're talking Pay It Forward. We're talking about the state of higher education. We're also talking about education funding more broadly. The Ways and Means Subcommittee just came out with their budget bill, I think, yesterday. What's the state of higher education funding in Oregon, Ben?
Well, the state is not great in a historical context. We're investing less as a state in higher education than we did in 1999, and that's not accounting for inflation. So, in non-inflation adjusted terms, we're spending less per student, I should be careful about that, than we were almost 16 years ago. And, of course, general inflation and education inflation in particular has run at 2-3%. You can do the math. We're really significantly underinvested.
Wait. Did you just say in dollars, non-inflation adjusted? Like we're in just the number of dollars on the page, we're spending less per student now than we were 15 years ago?
Yes.
So you factor in inflation, so we're spending a lot less per student
exactly.
than we were 15 years ago.
Exactly. And meanwhile, enrollment in Oregon public colleges and universities has increased considerably. So, you factor those two things together, and what spits out the other end is very high tuition charges to students, because the institutions have to find some way to cover the revenue to serve many more students and to do it with less state appropriation than they have before, and they turn to tuition, which is understandable given those circumstances. The good news is that the trajectory now, starting in with the 2013 budget and now looking forward to the 2015 budget, the trajectory is positive. The co-chairs, the Ways and Means co-chairs, have proposed pretty significant increases in institutional funding for community colleges and our public universities, and increases in the state's need-based aid program, the Oregon Opportunity Grant. So we think there's we're headed in the right direction, finally, fewer students, as a result of the improving economy, actually our colleges in particular are seeing a slowdown in enrollment. That's challenging on the one hand because it means fewer Oregonians turning to higher ed, where some great opportunities for long-term benefit await. On the other hand, it means, more resources, somewhat fewer students, and we should see some real positive effects on campuses over the next couple of years.
When Carly's tuition gets increased, or the tuition increase that was just proposed at Oregon State, what's that money go to? Is it just sort of spread across, or is it for, are there particular costs that are being increased, or particular investments that are being made?
So it differs from campus to campus. They set their own institutional budgets, the seven public universities, the 17 community colleges. So there's not a single answer. A significant portion of the expenses associated with higher education are similar to those at K-12 and other levels of education, namely the salaries and benefits of the instructors, the faculty, who are at the core of the educational process, that's where the biggest chunk of student tuition dollars go. Each of the institutions also has increased their emphasis on providing supports to students, the guidance, counseling, coaching, mentoring that is so critical for not merely enrolling students, getting those proverbial butts in seats, but also getting them to certificate and degree. And so that looks different at different colleges. The approaches that they take differ from institution to institution. But on the whole, you see institutions trying very hard to ramp up the amount of wraparound service that they're providing to support students to success. So, lots of different things that tuition dollars support, but those are two of the big categories.
Carly, you shared with me and then shared a portion of it on air that when you testified, the point that Representative Mark Johnson made, Republican from Hood River, was that, well, if we make it too cheap for students to go to college, they just will never leave. It'll be like their parents' basement. Why would they go to their own apartment if they can play PlayStation 9, in their basement? Was that roughly his argument?
Yeah.
So I want to ask Ben, do we have any evidence in nature that the higher or lower cost of education has a meaningful impact on the inability of people to graduate because they lack the motivation induced by high cost? Is that something that we should be worried about?
No, we have no such evidence. In fact, I'd say the evidence points in the opposite direction, that one of the significant drags on student success, on the completion of one of the barriers to completion of certificate or degree, is cost, and that we can expect to improve the rate of success for students by decreasing the cost. So, I would put it sort of 180 degrees differently, and I think the evidence suggests that.
So, I want to bring in a couple people on this. Nobody knew, but both your view, Alejandro and Ben, we just have a party line. Given the vastness of our studio, we can fit a lot of people here. The two forces you're against, Alejandro, and Ben, what we were talking about is the Pay It Forward proposal I know you're familiar with, the Working Families Party has pushed. two opposing forces and linked to arguments that you're facing, or one, this argument that, oh, the either real or mythical or rare or not so rare highly paid student is going to get hosed, or that person's not going to get hosed because they're just not going to opt in, although your point would be they don't know what they're going to be making. They'll do it based on whether they can afford school, whether it seems like the best deal, not based on a really good guess about what they're going to be doing with their lives. But that's one argument you're going to face. It's like, why should essentially education funding be means tested, right? If so, you liken it to Social Security. Social Security is not really based upon one's wealth. It's based upon what one pays into it. So that's one argument against you. The other argument against you is from Public Labor, who is saying, wait, no, just increase higher education funding. What have you heard from, I think it's AFT, American Federation of Teachers?
I think, and we're totally supportive of what they're saying, right? They want more money into public higher education, and no one's arguing about that. I think, one of the great things about the pilot is that we've designed it in such a way that it doesn't actually use existing public higher ed money. We're trying to use lottery funds and trying to figure out other investment options to fund the program. So it's not going to compete with grant aid, or if the legislature decides or finds more money to put it into public higher education.
Ben, have you taken the time to formulate a view, or has the commission formulated a view on the Pay It Forward pilot? The idea, you know, the basic policy proposal,
yes.
And the pilot. And just to be clear with listeners, the pilot proposal is not to do this with everybody, but to start with 1,000 students, start with about $6 million, and then spend over 4 years, the life of the pilot, 4 years life of the pilot,
right.
$56 million. Ben, start talking.
Sure. The commission spent considerable time working on developing the pilot, and we presented our recommendations relative to the pilot to the legislature in November of last year. So we've been very much involved in helping sort of develop this proposal. The commission concluded that this could work, that it could be fiscally sustainable for the state, and that it would serve an important and unfilled sort of niche in the higher education sort of affordability arena. The commission emphasized the value that this could have for students and their families who qualify for relatively little need-based aid, although it could certainly benefit some of those students too. It seemed to us like the primary benefits would be to students and families who may be just outside of the income thresholds for other forms of grants and scholarships. The commission found itself quite attracted to it. What it expressed, though, in its report to the legislature was concern about the final point that you raised, and that AFT has raised about the potential for crowding out other forms of higher education investment. And specifically, the commission said, let's make sure that doesn't happen. I think, as your other guest noted, we're all on the same page about that. We don't want to see upfront investments in this program come at the expense of investments in state need-based aid, which is a particular priority for my commission, or for institutional support, which is also a priority for us and others. So it's a good, interesting program that we think is could be launched in the upcoming biennium.
One of the counterarguments is not only this idea, well, does this take some of the wind out of the sails for higher education funding, but it's an actuarial question. It's essentially, if you only have, and I think maybe the question's been fully answered, but I'd love to get you to weigh in on it, and Alejandro gave some helpful thoughts, that if only the students who take advantage of it are only those students with a lower anticipated post-graduation salary, then does that present revenue difficulties, that present funding difficulties for the program, right? If it's only the teachers who are paying into it and the investment bankers aren't, although there's not that many investment bankers, then is it still solvent at this 4% level? What do we know?
Yeah, so we explored that a lot because we had some of the same concerns. And the modeling for the actuarial modeling does take into account some of that skewing effect towards folks who may anticipate and in fact have lower income careers, or the non-participation of people who expect to have higher income careers. So, it was important to us to take that into account, although we agree with Alejandro that many students just don't know. And so we may not be as concerned as some about that phenomenon. I do want to point out one thing, that even since we began this work a year ago on Pay It Forward, one of the things that's become increasingly clear to us and to my commission is the increasing availability and popularity of income-based repayment options for federal loans. So many of your listeners and many students have and may be repaying or taking advantage of federally subsidized loans. That's distinct from private loans, which tend to have higher interest rates and that many students also require in order to afford college. But at least for those federal loan programs, there are today, through action by Congress and the administration, there are income-based repayment options with forgiveness of the balance after 10, 15, or 20 years, depending on what option you're in and what career path, whether you're in public sector work or not. That approximate many of the benefits of a Pay It Forward program. Again, it's not the full meal deal. It doesn't cover private loans. It doesn't cover the full cost of education. But I think it's important, especially for folks who may be considering higher education and daunted by what appear to be these very high debt burdens, to know that at least on the federal lending side, income-based repayment is a way to get the advantage of Pay It Forward, namely paying only a portion of your income. And if you're a social worker, it's a relative, it's the same portion as if you're a high-income earner. That has exploded in popularity and availability over the last couple of years.
Alejandro, what do you have to say about that?
Yeah, I agree. I think because student debt is in crisis right now, that the expansion of income-based repayment has been really great. However, that doesn't solve the problem, the budget problem that we have in the state, right? Where we would create a public education fund for the state that would then be, will be working towards being solvent or at least contribute back to the state. Right now, the payments that, recently the federal government made almost $127 billion off of student loans in the next 10 years. And that money, is going back to the federal government and, to the budgets. Oregon can have a similar, a budget that, we wouldn't necessarily be in the same situation where we don't have the funds to send people to school. So one of the other aspects of Pay It Forward is that it's a self-sustaining model, or right. we can work towards making it a self-sustaining model for Oregon.
Ben, I know you've got a 12:30. Any closing word?
I've been thinking a lot about the affordability piece, and this is a really good conversation. We focus a lot on tuition, and understandably, it's the sticker price people see. I hope that as folks explore higher education, they'll look at the cost, which is the sticker price, but minus whatever grants and scholarships or other forms of assistance may be available. But that they'll also, beyond that, they'll take into account, the field that they're planning to go into, and whether or not they're going to complete. I mean, I think the biggest distinguishing factor between the best way to distinguish between students for whom higher education is affordable and those for whom it's not turns on whether they completed certificate or degree. The data is just overwhelming that degree earners still, even with relatively high debt loads, still are doing well for themselves economically on average, given the payoff, the earnings payoff that results from having a degree versus not having a degree. The real problem are students with high levels of debt and no degree. And that I think that's a policy question. It's also a question for individuals as they assess their sort of likelihood of success at a college or university. So we need a multi-pronged approach to affordability. I think Pay It Forward can be a great arrow in that quiver, as can enhancing the state's need-based aid program, the Oregon Opportunity Grant, working with the feds to improve the Pell program and expand the Pell program.
You're getting it all in there. That's excellent. Ben, thanks so much. Carly, thank you. So I want to correct one thing. You're not in Cancun. You're not taking lavish vacations. One of our listeners says, well, how can she afford a lavish vacation if she's taken on debt for school? You didn't say you were doing that. I did, because I made a dumb joke. Any closing word from you?
All we really have to say is that for the Pay It Forward, there's don't be so quick to dismiss current and future students. Education shouldn't be a debt sentence.
All right. Alejandro.
I just want to, you know, clear up one
like
thing.
9 seconds.
Pay It Forward is not a loan. So the big difference between income-based repayment and Pay It Forward would be that you're not, you know, you wouldn't necessarily be holding this your debt load to your grave, which is currently what exists for loans. And
that's the bad news about something that's just a loan that's a payback based on income.
Right.
Is that great? I'm only I'm only paying a percentage of my income, and I'm doing it for the rest of my life. And over the course of that, I'm paying a lot more for my education than somebody who had more money. So right now we actually have a reverse, a regressive system of payment for higher education.
Right, where, you know, the people who don't have the means for education actually end up paying a third more for their education. And I think Pay It Forward would help solve that problem and make it better for working families across the state.
Alejandro, Carly, thank you so much for joining us. You're listening to Thank You Democracy.
Thank you.
In just a second, we're going to be talking with Christy Split of the League of Conservation Voters more on the legislative session in like 20 seconds. This is X-Ray.
Support for X-Ray FM comes from the World Affairs Council of Oregon. For more than 60 years, the World Affairs Council has been connecting Oregonians to the world through youth and education programs, professional connections with international visitors, and through public conversations with inspiring global leaders. Who we are, where we're going, how we're getting there. More information available at worldoregon.org.
And we're back. This is Thank You Democracy. I'm Jeff. We're talking legislative session. We're talking about the 5 months every 2 years that Oregon's lawmakers decide who we want to be as a state and how we're going to get there, or at least how the heck we're going to pass a budget and appease some set of interest groups that are pushing for proposals or pushing back on proposals to either maintain or change the status quo. We have a change agent on the phone right now, Christy Split, of the League of Conservation Voters, the political arm of the environmental movement. Christy, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on the show today, Jefferson.
It is delightful to hear your voice. So what marvelous things for the environment is the legislature doing? What is climate change, is it fixed already, or is it going to take a couple more weeks? What is the marvelous set of accomplishments you've already finished up on?
Well, we haven't been able to completely fix climate change yet. I know this is disappointing news, but
air conditioners.
But we did take one big step in the right direction. And, you know, for somebody who values gratitude and democracy as much as you do, they'll understand why I say thank you to our legislature for passing the Clean Fuels Bill. We actually had
the Oregonian newspaper didn't like it.
No, yeah, we had a huge lift, is what I was getting ready to say, to pass it's an existing program that needed the sunset lifted in order to continue into existence. And the program aims to reduce the carbon intensity of our fuels by 10% over 10 years. So that takes a big chunk out of our greatest contributor to our greenhouse gas emissions, our transportation sector. So we were really excited to see that pass, although, like I said, it was a huge lift, and we are mostly filled with gratitude at this point for legislators for being willing to stand up to, you know, not just big oil, but really, frankly, the media, particularly the Oregonian, to say this is the right thing for our state, no matter what an editorial board says.
It was a big win. At the same time, what are your feelings about, and how much in frustration feelings are included, that for a relatively modest change, didn't say a modest mm-hmm. accomplishment, but a relatively modest change that was only keeping a law that was already passed. Okay, it wasn't saying, oh, geez, we're learning more. We just learned that the oceans are stopping moving. And so now we've got to go faster on climate change. It wasn't really moving faster. It was keeping something, although we haven't been implementing it because the implementing bureau was concerned that if it was just going to go away, why gear up? But does that discourage you a little bit? That's like, oh, geez, how the heck are we going to take on even tougher things? How would we say anything like a carbon tax if this was this big a fight? If the Oregonian is going to go to the mat over this, you know, what do you feel about that?
Right. And, you know, I will say that, you know, the reason that the program, it wasn't implemented, had a lot to do with the existence of a sunset. We knew that the economic development potential of the bill, which was necessary to its success and also necessary to it really being the best solution for Oregon, you know, we knew that the sunset made investment in Oregon a challenge. If you could go to California where they didn't have a sunset on a similar program, you would go there and invest your money there, right? Just logical. So lifting the sunset to us, you know, was somewhat of a big deal in that it allowed the program to move forward. I think really what I wish is we hadn't allowed the sunset to ever get put in place to begin with, because it did chill the economic development potential. But to answer your question, you know, I think we in the environmental community and our advocates were really excited to sort of turn to the next thing on climate. We didn't want to take a victory lap and say, you know, wash our hands. We are done for now. Instead, we've been working really hard on a policy that would stop coal power from being sold in Oregon. Essentially, we're closing our only coal-fired power plant in 2020, but we still get a third of our power from coal, and a lot of that comes by wire from other states. So coming up with a policy that says we're not even going to buy that dirty power here in Oregon. We want it to be 90% cleaner than coal power, in fact, and really invest, or really, you know, encourage investments in our renewables here in the state. So we are already working on what comes next, and I guess we'll see how chilling the effect is, but when it comes to coal, you know, the evidence is really clear that it's not just about climate, it's about public health too. And so I think what we've chosen to do is say one thing down and what's the next thing and to keep pushing.
So what's a lobby day?
What is a lobby day?
Yeah.
A lobby day is when lots of, when any constituents come down, any, you know, average citizens in Oregon come down to the Capitol and meet with their legislators. And it could be a little lobby day where you have a dozen folks come down, or it could be what we had yesterday, which was around 200 folks come down to the Capitol to talk to their legislators about environmental issues, which we had yesterday. We had the environmental lobby day for the year.
So this is, and this was the OSV lobby day, this was the Oregon Conservation Network lobby day, and I want to explain what that is in a moment.
Yeah, it was the Oregon Conservation Network did the lobby day with all of our groups. We have over 42 organizations, and about five of the groups really decided to get into it this year and spread the word and reach out to our membership. So it was really, for maybe the first time, it was truly a group effort among just a few of the groups in the Oregon Conservation Network really leading the way. But I think that's why we had such a great turnout. But the Oregon Conservation Network is a coalition of 40 organizations around the state that work together on environmental issues.
So this, and I don't want to dazzle people with acronyms because I don't think it would dazzle you, but I do want to explain why this matters. So legislative bodies are yes-no bodies. They're also priority bodies. Too often questions are posed in binary fashion that, in fact, aren't binary questions. Should we vote for funding education or not is not a yes or no question. It's a how much. And it's not only how much for education, it's how much for education versus how much for other stuff. Outside the budgetary context, it's also very often a priority question because in a given committee, they're not going to do all the bills. How come? Some of it's just time, some of it's political will, some of it's how much they want to upset interest groups versus please other interest groups. And so when you go down to Salem as a member, or when you go down as a lobbyist, or if you go down as an interest group, what is asked of you very often is, what's your most important thing? What are your top three things? What are your top priorities? And then your champions, your allies, the people you gave political contributions to, the people that you canvassed for, if you're the legislative member, the person on leadership who's going to, like the speaker or the whip or the majority leader, is going to push your stuff. If you say voted for them for their leadership position, and they want to know what your really big things are, because you know, if you have 50 big things and you have zero big things. So a lot of it's about priority. The Oregon Conservation Network, the idea there is they get all the environmental groups together, or at least most of them, and say, what's the big stuff? You guys are each going to be lobbying on your own stuff, but what's the stuff we can come together around? What are the top priorities? We'll do a lobby day where we all are invited and we'll push those top things. So when the speaker, when the majority leader, when the whip says, what's the most important stuff for the environmental community, you have an answer to that question, and therefore you're supposed to get it done. That's the idea, right, Christy?
That is the idea.
How well does it work? I have a question that goes on in my own brain, whether this focusing accomplishes more, okay, or merely makes it feel better for lawmakers to not have to address every question. It clearly makes things less confusing. I don't know, and the conventional wisdom is the only way to do it, and anybody else who doesn't do it this way is dumb. But I have this question about whether it actually gets more accomplished or if it just makes us feel better because it's less confusing.
I actually think it does help us get more accomplished. So I've been working with this coalition for a couple of years now as the director of the coalition, and before that I was a legislative aide for 5 years.
For Ben Cannon, who we just had on the show. I know, it's our family.
Really? You just had Ben on?
Yes, we did. We were talking about higher education. That's what he does now.
Oh, there you go. Sorry, this is my old boss. You can tell I think very highly of him.
He's the best.
On the radio. Jefferson knows that I think very highly of him. But my old boss was the chair of the environmental committee in the House. And I think it had three different names while he was the chair of it. And so we worked closely with this coalition. And I think it really does help to both focus legislators, but also to focus the environmental community on just a few big things. And I think that cuts both ways. And even though focus does help us to feel better, I think it also helps us to work more wisely. Otherwise, maybe nothing would get done because you'd be so scattered.
Yeah.
And I think with such a big coalition with so many different interests, as you can imagine an environmental coalition would be, it would be easy to have every group have a different thing they're working on.
Yeah.
And by bringing everybody together, it makes it just so much more powerful.
On your lobby day,
there's an element of feeling better, but I think more importantly, it helps us focus our work.
On your lobby day, which lawmakers chased you out of their office?
Oh, gosh. You know, I've only heard of one story, and I won't even say who it is because they're actually somebody I really like, but I did hear a story about a rural Republican legislator pointing his finger and saying, "You guys, a whole bunch." So that doesn't feel too great when you're a constituent who comes in and you have your own legislator point at you as the enemy, saying, "You guys, you guys." So that's the one horror story, I suppose. I got yelled at a little bit by somebody in front of constituents. Oh, these things.
Who was it? Who was it?
I'm not going to tell you. No way.
Where do they represent?
I'm not going to tell you that either.
What district?
Mostly, I just think it's a good story.
Was it a man or a woman?
Yelled at. It was a male. How about that?
What political party?
The majority of the legislature, a Democrat.
And what was his name?
Just
one of them. Just what was his name?
You've got all you're going to get.
So in just a moment, we'll have Representative Shamia Fagan, who will give us a little update from her vantage point of what's been cracking in Salem. But one other question I want to ask before you go away. We're here with Christy Splitt. I'm Jefferson Smith. This is Thank You Democracy on X-Ray. We're talking about the legislative session. My diagnosis, or at least, a portion of my diagnosis, Christy, is that environmental power is at a lower ebb now than at other times in Oregon history. Not at all other times. It's greater now, for instance, with Democrats in control of both chambers of the legislature. It's much higher than it was when Democrats weren't in control. But it's lower than, say, the era when public beaches and the bottle bill were passed and Senate Bill 100.
I wax nostalgic for the early 70s.
Right. So
we had that era as well.
And part of my, and I have lots of reasons for this. I think a lot of it's dough. I think a lot of it's the fact that there aren't, that it, a reflection of what's happened with political parties. What are you feeling or what are you seeing with the state of environmental power and influence in Salem? Because it's not that environmentalists have become less important. People are more aware of climate change than they ever have been, for instance. Heck, in Florida, they don't even want you using that word anymore. But what are you seeing with the power structure?
You know, interestingly, I think the environmental community has asserted itself as a more powerful presence during election season. For better or for worse, I have mixed feelings about it myself. But I think that's one real shift that we've seen just in the last year or so, where the environmental community has actually really worked hard and smart, I suppose, to be a bigger player in the election cycle. We were I think, really pivotal in electing three pro-environment legislators at a time when the rest of the country was losing pro-environment legislators. So we're really proud of that work. And I think that, it's like sort of taboo to say it, but I don't think it's taboo to say it on your show, that there's a connection between how hard and smart we're able to play in elections and how hard and smart we're able to play in the Capitol. So I think actually, while I agree that it ain't the 70s, and I certainly wish it were, that we you know, are really making ourselves known by organizing and bringing the grassroots together. To me, it's no coincidence that we had our biggest lobby day turnout in years yesterday.
How many
at
people?
At the same time as we had about 200 people.
Nice.
Yeah, which is double what we had 2 years ago. So
on the line, we have Representative Shamia Fagan. We also have Christy Splitt, who I've been talking about. Representative Fagan, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I am well. Christy Splitt, any closing word, any thought you have, any question you have for Shamia or thought you want to share with the representative on the line before we pivot?
I guess I'll just say keep up the good work for East Portland and the rest of the state, Representative Fagan. I'm talking to two, you know, people who care deeply Portland, and so do I.
Christy Splitt, League of Conservation Voters. You can check that out by using, I think they call it the World Wide Web. If you go to https://www.olcv.org, and you can find on the www's more information. Thanks, Christy.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Shamia Fagan, how are things going in Salem?
They're going really well. How are you doing?
Other than having to trip over gold bars and diamonds and rubies in our studio and having so much cavernous space in the studio that I almost get agoraphobia even though I'm inside, I'm doing pretty well. What are you working on down in Salem? By Salem, I mean the capital of Salem is the capital of Oregon, and it's about 50 minutes to an hour south of Portland. It's about an hour north of Eugene. How's it going? What are you working on?
Going really well. We're having a very successful session. If you are someone who supports kind of progressive values and Oregon leading the way, as you, I'm sure, have talked about, Motor Voter, I think, is one of our big, you know,
big
achievements
deal.
That we did in February. That was a huge deal. We just learned that California's Attorney General Secretary of State has announced that they're going to pursue similar legislation down there. So it's always fun to be part of an historic session where Oregon's leading the way.
So let's talk education. So I was gonna talk about some of this before you were on the air, but you're on the air now, and I don't want to make you wait any longer because that'd just be rude. The Ways and Means Subcommittee, on a party line vote, voted out a $7.255 billion education budget. That is up from the $7.24 billion education budget that legislative leadership put forward at the beginning of the session. It's also up from what the governor had put out for education well before the session, and that was up from what we spent 2 years ago. However, there's almost nobody I know in education who thinks it's even close to enough, and you have the maybe odd, maybe not odd alliance of Republican legislative members and education advocates decrying this budget and saying this is woeful, it won't allow us, this is still a cuts budget, we'll still be closing school days, we won't be able to invest in teachers, we won't be able to do stuff on class size. And the Representative Shamia Fagan response is?
Well, that, you know, our parents and our teachers and the folks that we trust on the ground to educate our kids are things people that we have to listen to. Now, in terms of, you know, my colleagues across the aisle seizing on this opportunity, I certainly wouldn't say that inside the Capitol that those two groups are aligned, because the reality is the education advocates believe that we need to be, you know, raising revenue, asking, you know, large out-of-state corporations to pay their fair share, asking the wealthiest to pay their fair share so we can actually put forward a game-changing budget for our schools, whereas my impression of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle are simply seizing on an opportunity to, you know, say that, you know, that the Democrats aren't doing enough. So, but I agree. We need a game-changing education budget. I think that there's a weird, sophisticated problem going on. I actually did a virtual town hall. We're using some new technology to try and reach more people.
Called a telephone.
Incredible turnout. What's that?
A new technology called a telephone.
No, actually called GoToWebinar.
Oh, nice.
We actually do a visual virtual town hall.
Nice.
Where, what's that?
I said nice. It's just, I just,
yes,
being complimentary.
Thank you. I'm not adding much value. We used GoToWebinar. We had Peter Buckley on. We had a whiteboard behind us. And for an hour, we talked with people about the kind of the problem is that previous years there was this group of, so the bottom line is there's a difference of opinion on what the 7.255 budget actually will mean in terms of the real important part, which is how many dollars does each school get based on how many kids they have. And there's two different numbers. The Legislative Revenue Office, which obviously is our kind of economic nerds, come up with a certain number. The Oregon Department of Education economic nerds are coming up with a different number. And the difference between those two is how much the state will increase its property tax portfolio in the next biennium. Legislative Revenue, our nerds think it will be actually be about a 7% growth, but they're conservatively estimating at 5%. The Oregon Department of Education nerds are saying it's actually they're estimating it more at a 3%. So based on those two differences, there's a different set of numbers going out saying, no, this is how much schools should get per student, which is a non-cuts budget. That's what the co-chairs are relying on. And then the Oregon Department of Ed is saying, no, this is the amount that will go out per student, and that is a cuts budget. So that's actually the problem going on here, which I learned from the co-chair of the Ways and Means Committee, Peter Buckley, is that in previous years, the governor had always directed the Oregon Department of Ed nerds and the LRO, the Legislative Revenue Office nerds, to meet during the interim and agree on those numbers. And Governor Kitzhaber, kind of in an, I don't know if it was part of his education reform or whatever, disbanded that group. So for
go ahead.
Those communications did not take place. So that's why we now have two different sets of numbers. And
I do want to get off that just a little bit.
Numbers are cuts budget.
I want to get off that just a little bit because even, you know, whether it's, you know, a slight increase or a cuts budget or a stable budget, that matters. But the quality education model now calls for what? Like if you went for what the panel that was put together years ago says ought to go to make a quality education in Oregon, what does that call for now? $10 billion budget?
Oh, it's between $9 and $10 billion. Absolutely. Yeah. And I believe we're constitutionally required to fund that, which I think the courts held too. They just said there's no remedy in the statute.
Right.
So, no, absolutely. They're not wrong. They're absolutely right. The question is, when you look at a state budget, you know, the question is, okay, so do we close prisons and release violent criminals in order to get to that number, or do we ask, you know, corporations, out-of-state corporations, do we ask the wealthiest to pay their fair share in kind of a game-changing revenue move so that we can actually have the dollars that we need to both keep our
community
safe, care for the most vulnerable, and fund our schools?
We've got five more minutes, maybe six, and let's talk about that. So I was having a conversation with a friend of mine who I think had an interesting insight, which is that what happens is, if you, there'll be interest groups who are happier with this legislative session than education advocates are, right? There'll be people who are fighting for budgetary money who will be fully happy. And SEIU, who has, you know, much of Tina Kotek, Speaker of the House's staff, is former SEIU folks. They have done amazing organizing work over the last 10 years and on both the electoral side as well as the staff development side. And SEIU will finish this session happier than, let's say, the Teachers Union or Stanford Children or other education advocates. There are other folks who fight for budgetary money who will be happier. And I want to understand sort of the politics of this. And I think part of it is that if you have an extra, let's say, $100 million, $100 million would help education, sure, but it's not going to fix the education problem because the hole is so big. But if you're on Ways and Means full committee or you're on Ways and Means subcommittee, $100 million would fix all of AFSCME's problem with community corrections. It would fix much of SEIU's problem with, let's say, home care workers or some other thing they're working on. It would more than cover multiple sort of economic development programs that people are trying to push for a few million dollars here, a few million dollars there. And so you either... So if you're just kind of counting political noses, it's way easier to spend that $100 million on those other groups because you're really going to do something for them. Whereas even if you, as we've seen this game of adding $20 million, adding $20 million, adding $80 million, as has been happening for the last few months with the education budget, At the end of the day, you're still going to get Republicans voting no on it, even though they won't vote yes for revenue. And you'll still get education advocates saying, not wrongly, that it's not enough. Is that a relatively fair portion of the dynamic? What would you add or subtract?
Now, as my disclaimer, I'm not on any of the budget committees, right? So I'm operating on information other people have given me. Two things that add a little bit of a sophisticated analysis to that. One, I don't know that the other advocates are as happy or happier than education advocates to even get to where the co-chairs believed we have a no-cuts budget at 7.255. Human Services is down $140 million from where they need to be made whole, and Corrections is down, I forget the number, but it's tens of millions as well. So even at the current standard, so I think that there's some concern there for folks that do care about those issues. The second thing is, it's my understanding that the bill that did come out of Ways and Means actually has a trigger for education that says if the May forecast shows that for the 15-17 projection we're up, automatically half of whatever we're up goes to education. So they did put that trigger in there in an attempt to, you know, do more with schools. Now, the other concern is that we're budgeting with the concern of a $350 million kicker hanging over our head. The good news for schools, which may not be the same good news, which may be bad news for SEIU and AFSCME and other people who care about, Oregonians just in different areas other than schools, is that the kicker kicks, the school's budget, if it already passes, is at least the floor. It's as bad as it's going to get, depending on how you look at it. It is kind of held safe, as opposed to these other budgets would then have to deal with kicker realities. So that's also in play here.
Anything else? I want to ask if there's anybody you want to thank. We want to start doing some kind of thanks for good public work to close the show. But anything else you want to plug or raise in our last minute and a half?
Well, I'll just quickly rattle through. We're working on some bills that are really hoping to help working families just to accept the fact that our workplace is not the 20th century anymore, with one parent working full time and the other parent staying at home. So we're working on paid sick days, retirement security, parental leave for things like school conferences, et cetera, and some attacks on some predatory scheduling to make sure that families can get predictable or flexible schedules when it doesn't create an undue burden on the employer.
That's great. I would also just put a plug to you that now is a time to get, I mean, there's a couple of proposals out there for essentially wealth taxes to fund education. This is the time, it seems to me, to get some Republicans on the record to either oppose or support that. If they're going out and whacking them, I just got an email from John Davis decrying the education budget.
Right.
This is the time to say, all right, well, here's a couple of proposals to really juice it, not by $50 million, $100 million, but by over $1 billion. You down? Of course, he'll say no. It's an old game, but probably still good to let people know what's going on. Anybody you want to thank to close the show? Anybody who's done wonderful work who's underthanked?
Yeah, I want to give a plug for Family Forward Oregon. They are just doing a phenomenal job this session on these working families bills, coming forward every time, bringing parents and families that need the legislature to step up and accept the workplace realities we have today. They bring sophisticated, intelligent analysis to the dais every time, and I really appreciate Family Forward Oregon for the work they're doing.
The bus project gave them office space, helped them get started.
Oh, wonderful.
That was Caitlin Baggett arranged that. I think she's still proud of it. I want to say thank you to Shamia Fagan, state representative from East Portland and Clackamas County. Thanks for joining us. Thanks also to Ben Cannon and to the Working Families Party for joining us in our conversation about higher education, education funding generally, and also Christy Splitt from the environmental movement. Shamia, thanks so much.
Thanks, Jefferson.
Well, that was the end of our hour, gang. Legislative session is still happening. Big stuff's cracking. You're listening to Thank You, Democracy. I'm Jefferson Smith. Thanks to our guests. Thanks to you. Membership drive coming up. Make sure you up those memberships. And thank you, Democracy. Stay tuned for News of My Dad.
Arguing. Is all that discussion and debate about you?
Yeah, I'm one of the lucky ones. Most bills never even get this far. I hope they decide to report on me favorably.
KXRY Portland, 107.1 FM and 91.1 FM. X-Ray.FM around the world. Stay tuned for News of My Dad.
Then I go to the Senate and the whole thing starts all over again.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill.
Support for X-Ray FM comes from Koala Outdoor, Portland's homegrown outdoor advertising provider, putting businesses in touch with target audiences through wall space messages throughout the City of Roses. More information and contact info at koalaoutdoor.com. Help local advertisers help you.